Welcome to this deep dive. I want to start off today by asking you to picture a scenario that I think is going to feel, well, I know it feels incredibly uncomfortably relatable.
Oh, I think we all know the exact feeling you're talking about.
Right, so you're sitting on your couch at the end of a long day, you pull out your phone, you open up your news feed, and you just start scrolling.
And instantly it's just a wave of anxiety.
Complete overwhelm. First, you see an article about record-breaking climate issues. Maybe it's a historic drought-threatening crops or a superstorm wiping out a coastal grid.
Yeah, just massive ecological red flags.
Exactly. And then you scroll down, and the very next headline is about intense political polarization. People seemingly living in entirely different hostile realities, and they're just unable to agree on basic facts.
Right, totally fragmented.
Yeah. And you scroll again, and it's a piece on deep economic stress. You know, stubborn inflation, supply chains buckling, or infrastructure literally crumbling. And if you're anything like me, you sit there staring at your screen wondering, are all these things just a series of unfortunate separate fires that we happen to be fighting all at
Or is there
once?
something deeper going on?
Right. Are they actually connected? Are we looking at different symptoms of one massive interconnected system that is somehow misfiring?
That exact sense of overwhelm you're describing is essentially the defining psychological state of our current era.
It really is. It feels heavy.
And the reason it feels so heavy, so unmanageable, is because we are almost always given the symptoms without ever being shown the underlying anatomy.
The anatomy.
Right. The daily news cycle tells us about the political crisis or the economic crisis or the ecological crisis as if they exist in completely isolated silos.
Like they have nothing to do with each other.
Exactly. We treat the drought as a weather problem, the inflation as a banking problem, and the polarization as a social media problem. But they aren't isolated. They are deeply structurally bound together at a level most of us never get to see.
And that is exactly why we are so incredibly excited about the source material for today's deep dive. We're going to look at the anatomy of those connections. We are unpacking a profoundly insightful paper published in 2026.
It is a remarkable piece of work.
It really is. It's titled Reflexive Civilizational Governance, Life Ground Viability, and the Architecture of Human Survival. Now, for some context, this is actually the third paper in a highly regarded series known as the Violence Viability Trilogy.
By Dr. Bechara Saheeli.
Yes, Dr. Bechara Saheeli, who has this absolutely fascinating background. He is a physician, specifically an internal medicine specialist who is also a systems thinker.
Which completely changes the lens through which you view society.
It does. He literally looks at human societies the same way a doctor looks at a biological organism. But here is the kicker, and I love this detail. The paper is co-authored and analytically collaborated on with an AI.
ChatGPT 5.3.
Right. An AI and a doctor.
It's a really brilliant collaboration, especially given the sheer scale of the subject matter. Here we have a human physician who implicitly understands the biological imperatives of survival and an advanced artificial intelligence system capable of processing massive amounts of data.
They're working together to analyze what they call the cognitive infrastructure of human civilization.
It's incredibly fitting. An AI and a doctor diagnosing how societies process information, how they generate knowledge, and how they make the life or death decisions required to survive.
So, what is the mission of this deep dive today? Our goal is to equip you with a totally new mental map. We are going to examine the literal anatomy of human civilization.
We need to understand how societies actually manage to survive for centuries and why they can suddenly appear to collapse completely overnight.
And most importantly, whether humanity can develop the kind of systemic self-awareness we desperately need to thrive on a planetary scale.
And to frame this properly from the start, we need to ask the core question that drives all of Dr. Saheeli's work. Can human civilization develop institutions capable of sustaining life within Earth's ecological boundaries while simultaneously preserving human flourishing?
That is the big question.
It is. And I want to emphasize right up front that this is not just an academic exercise. This is an abstract philosophy meant for a university seminar.
Oh, it's very practical.
This is about understanding the very real why behind the global instability we see in the news every day. It's about learning how to recognize the early warning signs of systemic failure in our own society before it's too late to reverse course.
Okay, let's unpack this. The paper introduces this foundational concept called the five-layer architecture of civilizational viability.
Right, the five layers.
And to build this architecture, Dr. Saheeli integrates the work of two major thinkers, John McMurtry and Johann Gottem. Now, before we even get to the five layers, can you give us a quick primer on what these two bring to the table?
Absolutely.
Because the paper throws around terms like McMurtry's life value onto axiology, which sounds like something I'd need a PhD just to pronounce, let alone understand.
Gladly. Let's start with that intimidating term. Onto axiology. It is quite a mouthful.
It really is.
But if we break it down, ontology is the study of being, or what exists, and axiology is the study of value.
Okay, being and value.
So John McMurtry is basically asking, what is the fundamental thing that a society actually values at its core? What is the root of all value? His premise is beautifully simple. The ultimate value of any society is the life ground.
The life ground?
Yes. The life ground is the fundamental ecological and biological reality that allows life to exist at all. We're talking about breathable air, clean water, fertile soil, and rich biodiversity.
The physical stuff keeping us alive.
Precisely. McMurtry argues that all economic or social value must ultimately derive from the life ground. If an economic system produces massive financial wealth, but destroys the water cycle in the process, it hasn't actually created value. It has destroyed the foundation of life itself.
So if a society values capital or specific ideology over the literal biological systems that keep humans alive, it is structurally setting itself up for collapse.
That's exactly it. Now pair that with the second thinker, Johann Galtung.
Okay, what does he bring in?
When we hear the word violence, we almost always think of direct physical harm, a punch weapon of war. But Galtung introduced this incredibly powerful idea of structural violence.
Structural violence.
Right. This occurs when a system, an institution, or a society is organized in a way that inherently deprives people of their basic human needs, even without a single shot being fired.
But wait, let me play devil's advocate here for a second to represent our naturally skeptical listeners.
Go for it.
Isn't some level of friction or inequality inevitable? Like in any complex society, you're going to have winners and losers. You're going to have unequal resource distribution. How does the paper differentiate between normal societal friction and this fatal structural violence?
That is exactly the right question to ask. Normal friction is when a system is generally functioning well, but occasionally falls short. Maybe a specific policy doesn't work as intended, or there's temporary economic hardship during a transition.
Right, just the growing pains of a society.
Exactly. Structural violence, on the other hand, is baked into the architecture itself. It's when a society has plenty of resources, but its economic or legal system is designed in such a way that it leaves a massive portion of the population chronically starving or perpetually without health care, or forces them to live in highly polluted areas.
Ah, so it's a feature, not a bug.
It's not a glitch in the system. It is the system. Dr. Saheeli takes McMurtry's focus on the life ground and Galtung's concept of structural violence and uses them to build this five-layer architecture. He wants to show us exactly how a civilization is stacked on top of biological reality and where that violence gets hidden.
Okay, let's go through this architecture layer by layer, starting from the absolute bottom up.
The foundation.
Layer one is what we just talked about, the life ground. This is the ultimate ecological foundation. We are talking about the planet's climate stability, the biogeochemical cycles, biodiversity, the fresh water you drink, the topsoil that grows the food in your fridge. It is the absolute bedrock of existence.
Without layer one, nothing else exists,
period.
It's a non-negotiable foundation.
Yeah.
You cannot negotiate a peace treaty with a disrupted water cycle, and you cannot debate with depleted topsoil. It doesn't care about your politics or your GDP.
And moving up from that bedrock, we have layer two, which is infrastructure systems. I like to think of layer two as the pipes and wires. This is how human beings physically transform the raw, chaotic life ground into predictable human survival.
The physical manifestations.
Yeah, it's the water treatment plants that make the river water safe to drink. It's the agricultural supply chains, the massive power grids, the hospitals, the road networks. It is the physical, tangible manifestation of our survival strategy.
And to manage all those physical pipes, wires, and roads, you need layer three, institutions.
The rule book.
Exactly. This is the realm of governance, public administration, legal systems, and economic frameworks. If layer two is the pipes, layer three is the rule book. The institutions determine who gets to use the pipes, who is responsible for maintaining them, how much it costs to turn on the tap, and what the penalties are for polluting the water source.
Which brings us to layer four, and I know this is a massive focus of the paper. Layer four is the epistemic commons.
The nervous system.
Yes, we can think of this as the nervous system of a civilization. It includes scientific research, public education, the media data networks, and the general flow of information. It's how a society perceives reality, how it processes facts, and how it shares knowledge among its citizens.
And finally, sitting at the very top of the stack is layer 5, cultural narratives.
The stories.
Right. This includes our collective identity, our religions, our political ideologies, our shared myths, and our historical memory. It is the layer that gives meaning to everything happening below it. It is how we explain ourselves to ourselves and how we justify the rules we made in layer 3.
So just to recap for you listening, we have the life ground at the bottom, then infrastructure, then institutions, then the epistemic commons, and finally cultural narratives on top.
That's the stack.
Now, how do these layers interact? Because they aren't just stacked statically on top of each other like a layer cake. They are constantly communicating and putting pressure on each other.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, we have to look at the flow of stress versus the flow of regulation.
Okay, stress versus regulation.
Dr. Salili points out that systemic stress almost always bubbles up from the bottom. Imagine a severe multi-year drought down in layer 1, the life ground.
Right, so no rain for years.
That immediately puts immense stress on the agricultural infrastructure in layer 2. That infrastructure strain, crop failures, supply shortages, puts massive pressure on the economic institutions in layer 3.
Because food prices skyrocket, people lose jobs.
Exactly. Those failing institutions then rely on the epistemic commons in layer 4 to report, analyze, and communicate the crisis to the public. And finally, that widespread panic forces the cultural narratives in layer 5 to try and make sense of why people are suddenly going hungry.
So the problem, the stress rises upward through the floorboards.
But the solution, the regulation has to flow downward from the ceiling. Culture shapes the kinds of questions the epistemic commons even bothers to ask. The verified knowledge generated by the epistemic commons should then directly inform the institutions. The institutions then pass laws and allocate funding to build better, more resilient infrastructure, which in turn protects and sustainably manages the life ground.
That makes perfect sense.
When these 5 layers are aligned and communicating clearly, a civilization is viable. It is stable. But when they misalign, when economic institutions decide to ignore the degradation of the life ground for short-term profit, or when cultural narratives actively reject the scientific data coming from the epistemic commons, that is when structural violence and profound instability begin to accumulate.
That is such a powerful mental model. It suddenly makes all those disparate news headlines feel connected.
They are entirely connected.
Let's zoom in on layer 4 for a moment, the epistemic commons, because the paper makes an incredibly compelling case that this is the literal brain and nervous system of a society.
It's a great metaphor.
Think about your own body for a second. If you accidentally touch a hot stove, your nerves instantly send a lightning-fast signal up your arm to your brain. Pain, heat, danger.
And you pull away instantly.
Right. Your brain processes that information in milliseconds and immediately tells your muscles to pull your hand away. You absolutely need that nervous system to feel the burn and react. A civilization is no different, right?
Not at all.
It needs scientific research to measure the burn, say, rising global temperatures, or a massive spike in economic inequality. It needs the media to quickly transmit that danger signal to the public, and it needs education to help the citizens understand the context of the pain.
This raises an important question. What happens when a civilization's nervous system is fundamentally damaged?
Ooh, yeah. What happens when we can't feel the burn?
The paper explores this through the concept of epistemic degradation. And according to the analysis by Dr. Sekeli and ChatGPT, we are currently living through a profound historical crisis of collective perception.
How so?
Our modern information ecosystem has fundamentally changed in a very short period of time. Historically, we relied on established, albeit imperfect, gatekeepers.
Like major newspapers and universities?
We had universities, scientific academies, and professional journalism to act as a filtering mechanism to verify facts before they reached the broader public. But the advent of digital media platforms and algorithmic recommendation systems has completely altered the incentive structure of how information is produced, distributed, and consumed.
Right, because the algorithm does not care if the information is an accurate reflection of the life ground.
It has no concept of the life ground.
It doesn't know what topsoil is. It only cares if the information keeps you engaged on the screen. And let's be honest, anger, outrage, and highly emotional, simplified narratives keep human beings engaged much, much better than a nuanced 40-page scientific report on soil degradation.
They do.
So the nerves of our society start misfiring. They start sending signals of pain about things that aren't actually burning us while ignoring the actual stove.
And the devastating result of this is that the epistemic commons fragments into parallel interpretive communities. We aren't just disagreeing on policy anymore.
We don't even agree on reality.
Exactly. Different groups of people literally inhabit different informational realities. They rely on entirely different sources of authority and possess entirely different frameworks for what even constitutes a fact. When this happens, establishing a shared understanding of a systemic threat becomes almost impossible.
The paper points out a terrifying consequence of this fragmentation, the massive gap between recognition and action. Let's apply this. If we look at the 2008 financial crisis as an analogy,
that's a great example.
The burn was the housing market about to default. The nerves were the few quantitative analysts and whistleblowers sounding the alarm looking at the data, but the brain, the institutions, ignored the pain signals.
They completely dismissed it.
Why? Because of this epistemic degradation, the signal was lost in the noise of everyone else saying the market was fine. The paper notes that scientific communities might detect a massive existential crisis decades before any real policy action is taken.
Decades of delay.
The hand is literally resting on the hot stove. The nerves are screaming, but the signal is getting lost in the static, so the muscle doesn't pull the hand away. And the longer we delay, the worse the burn gets, all while society is busy arguing over whether the stove is actually hot or who turned the stove on or whether stoves are just a hoax invented by the media.
And it is absolutely crucial to state here, as the source material explicitly does, that this fragmentation must be viewed neutrally as a systemic breakdown.
Yes, we need to be very clear about that.
The paper does not point the finger at a specific political wing, neither left nor right. It doesn't blame one specific news network.
Yeah, it's not taking sides.
It views this deep polarization as a structural failure of the information environment itself. The technological and economic incentives of our digital platforms have created a landscape where reliable, peer-reviewed knowledge is forced to directly compete for attention with misinformation, hyper-partisan spin, and strategically manipulated content.
It's an unlevel playing field.
It is an architectural flaw in the societal nervous system, not just a moral failure of individual political actors or voters. When the environment itself is toxic, the neurons can't help but misfire.
That distinction is so important. It takes the personal blame out of it and allows us to look at it structurally. But okay, let's say we wave a magic wand and we somehow fix the nervous system tomorrow.
That would be nice.
Let's say the science is suddenly crystal clear. The media communicates it perfectly without bias, and absolutely everyone agrees that the stove is hot and we need to move our hand.
Okay, assuming the miracle happens.
We still have a massive, massive hurdle to overcome, which brings us to part three of our deep dive. The illusion of stability. Because even if the epistemic commons works perfectly, the layer right below it, institutions, is incredibly notoriously slow to change.
Yes, institutional inertia is a defining feature of modern governance, and it's often a fatal one.
They move like molasses.
They do. Institutions are inherently built for stability and predictability. They are built on centuries of legal precedents, incredibly slow bureaucratic processes, and crucially short-term political election cycles. Furthermore, they are incredibly siloed.
Right. The left hand doesn't know what the right hand is doing.
Exactly. The Department of Agriculture is rarely talking to the Department of Energy, and neither of them is adequately coordinating with the Department of Public Health.
I mean, try telling your local city council or the Department of Motor Vehicles to engage in rapid, long-term ecological adaptation. Most of these bureaucracies can barely plan for the Friday lunch rush.
It's funny, but it's true. When these massive, slow-moving institutions face a rapidly changing dynamic environment, like ecological collapse or a sudden technological paradigm shift, their natural tendency is to prioritize short-term continuity over long-term adaptation.
Because of the incentives.
Right. Politicians need to win the next election in 2 years. Corporate CEOs need to hit the next quarterly earnings target in 3 months. There is zero incentive to take a painful short-term hit for a long-term, decades-away benefit.
So they just ignore the long-term.
This creates what Dr. Saheeli calls systemic drift. Society just continues operating on an outdated rule book that is gradually, invisibly becoming dangerously misaligned with the actual physical reality of the life ground.
Here's where it gets really interesting. The paper includes a fascinating concept, complete with analytical charting by the AI, called temporal elasticity.
This is one of the most powerful concepts in the paper.
I want to spend some time on this because it blew my mind. Temporal elasticity is the idea that a society can look perfectly stable on the surface.
Totally fine.
The stock market might be hitting all-time highs, the GDP is growing, the politicians are giving incredibly confident speeches on television, but underneath it all, the ecological or social foundation is completely rotting away.
Temporal elasticity is, in essence, how a society borrows resilience from the future to mask its present decline. It's a temporal magic trick.
Barring from the future.
The paper identifies the specific mechanisms of how this illusion is maintained. How does a society look so wealthy and stable while its life ground degrades? It does it primarily through four methods.
Okay, let's break these down.
First, debt expansion. Printing massive amounts of money or leveraging extreme credit to maintain living standards that the physical economy can no longer actually support.
So just putting the entire civilization's lifestyle on a credit card.
Exactly. Second, aggressive resource extraction. Depleting the natural capital, like overfishing the oceans or clear-cutting forests, faster than it can regenerate. This creates a temporary surplus that looks like wealth.
But you're just eating your seed corn.
Right. Third, technological substitution. This is when we invent a new powerful chemical fertilizer to keep completely exhausted dead soil producing crops for just one more decade. We substitute technology for biological health.
It works until it doesn't.
And finally, political messaging. Using the epistemic commons to constantly reassure the public that everything is under control, that the fundamentals are strong despite the physical evidence to the contrary.
It is basically applying a massive amount of societal shock absorbers to a car that is driving over a cliff.
That's a great image.
You are just kicking the can down the road. You are maintaining the perception of stability by sacrificing actual long-term ecological resilience.
Precisely. And this framework perfectly explains a phenomenon that historians and sociologists have marveled at for generations. Why civilizational collapse almost always feels so completely sudden to the people actually living through it.
Right. You read about the sudden fall of Rome or the rapid abandonment of Mayan cities. To the citizen on the street in Rome, the collapse of their society probably felt like it happened overnight.
One day you're at the Colosseum, the next the barbarians are at the gates.
Exactly. The economy just vanished. But structurally, looking back, the pressure had been building for decades, if not centuries.
The systemic drift had been widening the gap between their institutions and their life ground for generations. The Roman agricultural systems were failing. Their expansionist debt was unmanageable. The society was just stretching its temporal elasticity as far as it could possibly go.
Until the rubber band snaps.
The shock absorbers finally catastrophically wear out.
The debt can no longer be serviced by new growth. The soil cannot be chemically stimulated anymore. The fragile infrastructure fails under a single severe weather event. And suddenly the entire facade drops.
It wasn't a sudden collapse at all. It was a sudden revelation of a collapse that had been happening in slow motion for 50 years.
Which naturally leads us to ask a deeply human question. How do people process that kind of creeping existential anxiety when the life ground is secretly stressed, when the infrastructure is visibly fraying and the institutions are paralyzed by inertia? Where do everyday people turn to make sense of the fear they feel?
They turn to the top layer.
Layer 5, cultural narratives. Humans are fundamentally storytelling creatures.
We need narrative to survive.
When the world stops making sense, when the math doesn't add up and the crops fail, we desperately reach for a story to explain the pain. And this brings us to part 4, the stories we tell.
During periods of intense systemic crisis, when that temporal elasticity is stretched to the breaking point, specific narrative patterns almost always emerge. The paper refers to these patterns as cultural attractors.
Cultural attractors.
You can think of them as psychological gravity wells that societies inevitably fall into when they are under intense collective stress. Dr. Say Healy identifies 3 highly destructive attractors that tend to dominate public discourse during a crisis. The first one he outlines is CMT, which stands for Chosenness Myth Trauma.
Okay, let's unpack CMT. How does the story go?
The Chosenness Myth Trauma narrative, a community tells itself a very specific insular story. We have a unique divine or historical destiny. We are special chosen people.
Okay, sounds nice so far.
But tragically, we are always under threat. Always the victim of historical trauma at the hands of others. This narrative relies heavily on a romanticized, mythologized past, a golden age that was stolen from them, and it demands a constant paranoid hypervigilance about enemies.
So it turns sour.
Under stress, this narrative pushes a society into a highly defensive, confrontational posture. It becomes less about solving the actual ecological or economic problem and more about defending the tribe's honor or purity from outsiders.
It's a story of perpetual victimhood mixed with a superiority complex.
Exactly.
And then there's the second destructive attractor, which the paper calls DMA, or dualism, manichaeism, Armageddon. Now we need to define some jargon here. What exactly is manichaeism?
Manichaeism originally refers to an ancient religion, but in modern sociology and political science, it describes a worldview that divides everything into absolute stark contrasts of light and dark, good and evil. There is no gray area.
Okay, so I see this DMA narrative everywhere today. This is the story that says the world is strictly divided into good versus evil. There is no nuance. There are no complex systems, no overlapping incentives. There is only us, the righteous, and them, the wicked.
Pure black and white.
And we are inevitably heading toward an ultimate apocalyptic showdown where one side must be completely destroyed for the other to survive.
What's fascinating here is how incredibly effectively the DMA narrative oversimplifies massively complex structural problems.
It gives you an easy answer.
Right. If a society is facing severe regional water shortages or a deeply entrenched inflation crisis, those are complex, multi-layered issues. They involve global supply chains, historical climate patterns, monetary policy, and agricultural practices. But the DMA narrative rejects all that complexity.
And it points a finger.
It says, no, it's not a complex system failure. It's the fault of those evil people over there. If we just defeat them, if we destroy that political party or that nation, all our problems will magically be solved.
Right.
It literally turns an ecological or economic crisis into a holy war.
Which bleeds perfectly into the third attractor. RP, or repression projection. This is classic Freudian psychology applied at a massive civilizational scale.
It's very common.
The story goes, it is not our broken system that is the problem. Our way of life is perfect. It is their fault. Instead of looking inward and doing the incredibly hard, painful, politically unpopular work of institutional reform and fixing the structural violence at home, the society represses its own guilt and failure.
It pushes it all away.
It takes all that internal anxiety and projects it onto an external actor, maybe a rival geopolitical nation, or very frequently a marginalized minority group within their own borders.
These three attractors, CMT, DMA, and RP, are incredibly dangerous precisely because of how brutally efficient they are.
They work.
They do work. They mobilize people incredibly quickly. They harness deep-seated anger and existential fear and turn it into massive political energy.
Yeah.
But here is the fatal flaw. They completely blind the society to the actual structural problems causing the pain.
Because you're looking the wrong way.
You cannot fight a failing crop yield or a collapsing power grid by blaming a marginalized group. You cannot arrest your way out of a drought. The narrative successfully mobilizes the population, but it directs all that mobilization away from the life ground and toward destructive horizontal conflict between people.
It's like returning to our nervous system metaphor. The hand is on the stove, the nerves feel the burn, but the brain, corrupted by these cultural attractors, decides the pain is actually a curse placed on them by their neighbor.
Right.
So instead of just moving their hand off the stove, they grab a weapon and go attack their neighbor, all while their hand continues to burn to a crisp on the hot burner. It is a fatal misinterpretation of the pain signal.
That is a brutally accurate analogy.
But the paper doesn't just leave us with doom and gloom regarding narratives, thankfully. There is a positive side to layer five. Cultural narratives are not inherently toxic. There are also adaptive narratives.
Yes, and this is crucial for the blueprint of survival. Throughout history, societies have also drawn upon powerful narratives of cooperation, stewardship, and mutual responsibility.
We have good stories, too.
Many religious, philosophical, and indigenous traditions are rich with stories that emphasize humanity's deep interdependence with nature and with each other. When a society under stress is able to tap into these adaptive narratives, it can frame a crisis not as an excuse to attack a scapegoat, but as a shared generational challenge that requires collective sacrifice, scientific innovation, and mutual care.
The stories we tell ourselves literally shape our biological survival.
They determine whether we live or die as a society.
I want to help you, the listener, really visualize how all these forces interact, how the life ground, the institutions, the epistemic commons, and these narratives all push and pull on each other. So let's move to part five, navigating the stability landscape.
The phase space.
The paper uses this brilliant conceptual model called the civilizational phase space. I want you to imagine a vast, undulating physical landscape. There are deep, wide basins, almost like massive bowls carved into the earth, and there are high, precarious ridges separating these basins.
Okay, a landscape of bowls and ridges.
Now imagine your civilization, your society as a ball rolling across this landscape.
When a civilization is healthy, when its five layers are communicating and aligned, it sits comfortably at the very bottom of a deep basin. This represents systemic stability.
It's safe down there.
Because the basin is deep and the walls are steep, the civilization can absorb massive shocks. If there's a sudden economic downturn, a pandemic, or a natural disaster, The ball might get violently pushed up the side of the basin.
But it doesn't roll out.
No gravity, which in this metaphor represents the society's resilience, its functional institutions, its strong infrastructure, and its healthy truth-seeking epistemic commons, pulls the ball right back down to the stable center.
But as we talked about with systemic grift and the degradation of the life ground, that landscape is not made of stone. It is dynamic.
It changes shape.
As a society accumulates structural violence, as it recklessly depletes its natural resources, and as it allows its information ecosystem to fragment into angry echo chambers, the fundamental shape of the landscape literally changes. The bottom of the basin starts to rise.
It gets shallower and shallower.
And this introduces the terrifying dynamics of thresholds and tipping points.
The paper uses ecological analogies here to beautifully explain how this works in practice. Think of a clear, stable, freshwater lake. For years, agricultural runoff is pouring excess nitrogen and phosphorus into the lake.
Okay, the pollution is just flowing in.
But the lake absorbs it. The fish still swim. The water looks clear. It seems stable. The basin is still holding the ball. But internally, at a chemical level, the resilience is dropping.
The temporal elasticity is stretching.
Exactly. Eventually, the nutrient load hits a critical invisible threshold. And seemingly overnight, the entire ecosystem flips. The lake turns toxic, choked with a massive algae bloom, and everything dies.
It crosses the tipping point.
Or consider a dense forest that experiences repeated severe droughts and small fires until it crosses a humidity threshold and permanently transitions into a dry grassland.
Yeah.
It cannot go back.
In our civilizational landscape metaphor, as the basin gets shallower, the ball is creeping closer and closer to the tipping ridge. The society is losing its capacity to absorb shocks.
The shocks that used to be manageable.
What used to be a completely manageable crisis, a bad harvest, a market correction, now threatens to push the entire system over the edge. And once you cross that ridge, the descent is rapid, chaotic, and nonlinear. You don't slowly roll down the other side. You fall.
When a society is pushed over that tipping ridge, it enters what Dr. Safley calls the collapse valleys.
The collapse valleys.
This is where you see rapid cascading failures. A drought causes a food shortage, which causes a massive spike in prices, which leads to the breakdown of state legitimacy, which triggers mass migrations, which results in violent conflict.
And remember those destructive cultural tractors we just discussed? CMT, DMA, and RP.
They come back with a vengeance.
As a society crosses the ridge and the fear sets in, those toxic narratives act like an accelerant on a fire. They fuel identity conflict and external blame, completely destroying any remaining social trust.
Making it impossible to coordinate a systemic rescue.
Exactly, thereby accelerating the violent descent into the collapse valley.
So what does this all mean?
Right, if we are currently sitting in a shallowing basin, how do we fix it? How do we stop the ball from rolling over the ridge? Or better yet, how do we deepen the basin again so we can absorb the shocks we know are coming?
This brings us to part six. The core solution proposed by Dr. Savelys and his AI collaborator, reflexive governance.
Reflexive governance, I love this term. It sounds technical, but it's really about profound self-awareness at a civilizational scale.
Reflexive governance is essentially a civilization's ability to look in the mirror, clearly recognize the consequences of its own actions on the life ground, and change its behavior accordingly.
It's course correction.
It is the institutional capacity to constantly monitor, interpret, and rapidly adjust its relationship with the planet. It sounds like common sense, but executing it requires an incredibly sophisticated, seamless alignment of all five layers of our architecture.
The paper breaks this down into a specific five-step loop. Let's walk through this reflexive governance loop step by step, because this is quite literally the blueprint for human survival in the 21st century.
Step one is monitoring.
Monitoring.
Monitoring is the systematic, rigorous observation of the life ground. It is massive data collection. It is the scientific institutions, the satellites, and the sensors measuring atmospheric carbon tracking, global biodiversity loss, monitoring soil health, and checking the depletion rates of underground water tables.
You absolutely cannot manage what you do not accurately measure.
Exactly.
Step two is interpretation. Data on its own is just raw numbers on a server. It needs to be analyzed and contextualized.
This is where scientific expertise, risk assessment, and complex modeling come in. The scientists look at the dropping water table data from step one and interpret what that specifically means for next year's crop yield and food prices.
Step three is public deliberation. This is the crucial moment where the epistemic commons must really do its job. The scientific interpretation cannot stay locked in an academic journal.
It has to reach the people.
It must be communicated clearly and honestly to the broader public. It has to be debated in the media, taught in educational systems, and discussed by everyday citizens. The public has to integrate this new knowledge into their cultural narratives so they understand the stakes.
Step four is institutional response.
Mm-hmm.
Once the public and the policymakers truly understand the interpreted data, the institutions have to actually do something.
They have to act.
They pass new laws, they redirect massive economic investments, they build new resilient infrastructure. They fundamentally change the rules of the game to relieve the stress that was identified on the life ground.
And finally, step five is societal feedback. The loop must close. After the new policy or infrastructure is implemented, society has to carefully observe the results.
Did it actually work?
Right. Did the water table stabilize? Did the emissions drop? If yes, great, the basin is deepening. If no, the new data feeds right back into step one monitoring, and the cycle continues.
This is the definition of a society learning, adapting, and evolving in real time.
It's a beautiful, elegant model. But the paper is very clear and very sobering about the difference between success and failure here. Let's look at what happens when this loop breaks down.
The failure modes.
The paper uses the ongoing example of global climate governance as a classic tragic failure mode. The monitoring in step one and the interpretation in step two have actually been working incredibly well for decades.
They really have.
The global scientific community has been doing its job, sounding the alarm with massive, undeniable amounts of data and highly accurate models.
But the loop critically breaks at step three, public deliberation.
The signal gets jammed.
Because of the severe epistemic degradation we discussed earlier, the fragmented information ecosystems, the algorithmic amplification of doubt and outrage, and the capture of media by vested corporate interests, the scientific knowledge completely fails to translate into a shared, unified public consensus.
And because step three fails, step four, institutional response, is entirely paralyzed.
There's no mandate to act.
Politicians don't have the unified public mandate to make hard choices. Or worse, they are captured by the very industries that benefit from maintaining the destructive status quo. So the policy response is weak, watered down, or entirely non-existent.
The loop is broken.
The life ground continues to degrade, the basin gets shallower, and the society drifts dangerously closer to the tipping ridge. In a success mode, the signals propagate smoothly and quickly. Monitoring leads to knowledge, which leads to governance, which leads to adaptation. The system learns about itself and saves itself.
To help us measure exactly where we stand in this process, Dr. C. Healy includes an incredibly practical tool at the end of the paper.
Yes, Part 7, The Diagnostic Playbook and the Planetary Age.
Appendix A of the paper is a literal diagnostic framework. It is a series of targeted assessments for each of the five layers: the life ground infrastructure institutions, epistemic commons, and cultural narratives.
I want to invite you, the listener, to do this exercise with us right now. Think about the society you live in your specific country or region, and ask yourself these questions based on the paper's indicators. Let's run a quick mock diagnosis. Down in layer two, are we actively investing in resilient, adaptable infrastructure that can handle severe environmental shocks, or are our grids failing during every major storm?
Moving up to layer three, are our political and economic institutions actually capable of long-term ecological planning? Or are they entirely obsessively focused on the next election cycle and the next quarterly profit report?
Up in layer four, is our media and information ecosystem diverse, accountable, and actively promoting informed, nuanced deliberation? Or is it profiting off misinformation, algorithmic outrage, and partisan division?
And at the very top in layer five, do our dominant cultural narratives encourage stewardship, global cooperation, and shared responsibility? Or are our stories increasingly obsessed with identity polarization, historical grievance, and blaming external enemies?
If the answers to those questions in your head right now lean heavily toward the negative, you are seeing the glaring, flashing, early warning signals of systemic drift.
You are looking at a shallowing basin.
But the paper does not just diagnose the illness and leave us to despair. It provides the treatment plan. It outlines four actionable macro-level pathways to adaptation.
Pathway one. Reinforce the epistemic commons.
Fix the nervous system.
This is foundational. We have to fiercely protect the independence of scientific research. radically improve systems-level critical thinking in our public education, and perhaps most importantly, reform our digital media platforms so that their underlying algorithms prioritize transparency, accuracy, and truth over pure emotional engagement and outrage.
Pathway 2, enhance institutional adaptability. We need to design governance structures that legally incorporate long-term foresight. We need bodies that are insulated from short-term electoral panics, and we need true cross-sector coordination so that the environmental department is working hand-in-hand with the economic department rather than fighting them for budget.
Pathway 3, build resilient infrastructure. We have to completely redesign our energy grids, our water management systems, and our agricultural supply chains. And we must design them not just for maximum short-term efficiency and profit, but for long-term ecological alignment, redundancy, and shock absorption.
And pathway 4, cultivate adaptive cultural narratives. This is where everyone plays a part. We must actively elevate the stories, the historical memories, and the traditions that emphasize mutual care cooperation and our fundamental inescapable interdependence with the natural world and with each other.
This all builds to the profound concluding concept of the paper, what Dr. Saheli and the AI call the planetary age and the reflexive turn.
The planetary age.
If we look back through history, civilizations were always regional. If the Roman Empire collapsed or the Mayan civilization fell, it was utterly devastating for the people locally, but it didn't end human history. The global biosphere continued.
But today it's different.
Because of our technology and population, we are a globally coupled civilization. Our supply chains, our financial systems, and our climate impacts, they are inherently planetary.
We have entered an era where human activity is literally the dominant geological and biological force shaping the Earth system itself. The reflexive turn is the specific historical evolutionary moment we are standing in right now.
It is the realization that humanity must develop planetary scale self-awareness.
We have to evolve institutions that can consciously regulate our massive impact on the biosphere exactly the same way a healthy brain regulates a body's temperature. If we fail to make this reflexive turn, we are just blindly stumbling toward a planetary threshold from which we cannot return.
But if we succeed, if we can close that loop, we can establish a dynamic, sustainable alignment between our civilization and the life ground for centuries to come.
This has been a massive sweeping journey, and as we wrap up, I want to bring all these huge planetary concepts back down to Earth right to you, the listener. You might be thinking, this is fascinating, but I don't control the global institutions or the infrastructure. Why should I care about the reflexive governance loop or the civilizational phase space?
Because you play a role.
You should care because you are not just a passive observer sitting in the audience watching history happen to you. You are an active firing neuron in the epistemic commons. You are a living part of the society's nervous system.
Every single time you choose to verify a piece of information before sharing it online, you are literally strengthening the epistemic commons.
Every time you consciously reject a simplified hateful narrative, those toxic CMT or DMA attractors, and instead choose a narrative of nuance, empathy, and cooperation, you are helping to deepen the basin of stability for all of us.
Every time you vote for or demand long-term ecological planning from your local leaders, you are helping to close the reflexive loop.
Your daily actions, your conversations, what you click on, what you share, they either degrade the societal nervous system or they heal it.
And I want to leave you with a final thought to mull over, building directly on the profound implications of Dr. Saheli's and ChatGPT's work.
Let's hear it.
If human civilization is essentially trying to evolve a global brain in order to survive this planetary age, what is the true role and value of human attention? In an age of absolutely infinite information, perhaps our most vital civilizational duty isn't just what we physically build, but what we collectively choose to focus on. Are we truly paying attention to the critical signals of the life ground, the water, the soil, the changing climate, the structural inequalities in our communities? Or are we just amusing ourselves, distracting ourselves, endlessly arguing over manufactured algorithmic outrages as we drift silently toward the ridge?
That is the defining question of our time. Thank you so much for taking this deep dive into the architecture of human survival with us today. It is heavy, complex material, but it is also the ultimate roadmap for how we can consciously build a viable, thriving future together. Keep questioning the narratives, keep paying attention to the signals, and we will see you on the next deep dive.